Jackie poetically tells the story of one of the oldest black communities in Canada, Montreal's Little Burgundy, by way of a cinematic letter to Jackie Robinson, the first black man to break the color barrier in professional baseball. It also masterfully connects history to the present by challenging the myth of a post-racial society. This release is co-presented by Desta Black Youth Network, Tyndale St. George's Community Center, Canteen Bergs, and Makisia Solo. For more information and tickets, visit cinemapolitica.org. We hope to see you there. This is a CKUT co-presentation.
Good evening and welcome to the July 7th edition of Grey Matters. Tonight on the show, we have a lecture from Alternative Radio entitled Causes and Consequences of the Ukraine War. It was recorded in Florence, Italy on June 16th, a couple weeks ago. The lecturer tonight is John Mearsheimer. He is the R. Wendell Harrison Distinguished Service Professor in the Political Science Department of the University of Chicago. He is author of numerous books, including Why Leaders Lie, The Great Delusion, and the co-author of The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. So, without further ado, here's tonight's lecture, Causes and Consequences of the Ukraine War, by John Mearsheimer.
The tragic truth is that if the West had not pursued NATO expansion into Ukraine, it is unlikely there would be a war in Ukraine today. In essence, Washington played the central role in leading Ukraine down the path to destruction. History will judge the United States and its allies with abundant harshness for its remarkably foolish policy on Ukraine.
That's John Mearsheimer, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features John Mearsheimer on causes and consequences of the Ukraine war. The Russian invasion of Ukraine has triggered the most dangerous international conflict in decades, with ominous implications. It has already resulted in much death, destruction, and displacement. A disruption in food supplies may lead to famine in West Asia, Latin America, and Africa. And there is a possibility of the war escalating into something unthinkable. Understanding the root causes of the crisis is essential if we are to prevent it from getting worse and to find a way to bring it to a close. What role have the U.S. and NATO played historically and currently in Ukraine? What might a peace settlement look like? These are some of the questions addressed by today's guest, John Mearsheimer. John Mearsheimer is Wendell Harrison Distinguished Service Professor in the Political Science Department at the University of Chicago. He's the author of numerous books on international relations. He spoke at the European University Institute in Florence, Italy on June 16th. And now, John Mearsheimer.
The war in Ukraine is a multidimensional disaster, which is likely to get worse in the foreseeable future. I want to make two main arguments today. First, the United States is principally responsible for causing the Ukraine crisis. This is not to deny that Putin started the war and that he is responsible for Russia's conduct on the battlefield. Nor is it to deny that America's allies bear some responsibility, but they largely follow Washington's lead on Ukraine. My key point, however, is that the United States pushed forward policies toward Ukraine that Putin and his colleagues see as an existential threat to their country, a point they have made repeatedly for many years. Specifically, I am talking about America's obsession with bringing Ukraine into NATO and making it a Western bulwark on Russia's border. The Biden administration, was unwilling to eliminate that threat through diplomacy and indeed recommitted itself to bringing Ukraine into NATO during 2021. Putin responded by invading Ukraine on February 24th of this year. Second, the Biden administration has reacted to the outbreak of the war by doubling down against Russia. Washington and its Western allies are committed to decisively defeating Russia in Ukraine and employing comprehensive sanctions to greatly weaken Russian power. The United States is not seriously interested in finding a diplomatic solution to the war, which means the war is likely to drag on for months, if not years. In the process, Ukraine, which has already suffered grievously, is going to experience even greater harm. In essence, the United States and its allies are helping lead Ukraine down the primrose path. Furthermore, there's a danger that the war will escalate as NATO might get dragged into the fighting and nuclear weapons might be used. We live in perilous times. Let me now lay out my argument in greater detail, starting with a description of the conventional wisdom about the causes of the conflict. It is widely and firmly believed in the West that Putin is solely responsible for causing the Ukraine crisis and certainly the ongoing war. He is said to have imperial ambitions, which is to say he is bent on conquering Ukraine and other countries as well, all for the purposes of creating a greater Russia that bears at least some resemblance to the former Soviet Union. In other words, Ukraine is Putin's first target, but not his last. As one scholar put it recently, he is, quote, acting on a sinister, long-held belief to erase Ukraine from the map of the world. Given Putin's purported goals, it makes perfect sense for Finland and Sweden to join NATO and for the alliance to increase its force levels in Eastern Europe. After all, Imperial Russia must be contained. While this narrative is repeated over and over in the mainstream media and by virtually every Western leader, there is no evidence to support it. I want to repeat that. There is no evidence to support it. To the extent that purveyors of the conventional wisdom provide evidence, it has little, if any, bearing on Putin's motives for invading Ukraine. For example, some emphasize that he said that Ukraine is an artificial state, or it is not a real state. Such opaque comments, however, say nothing about his reason for going to war. The same is true of Putin's statement that he views Russians and Ukrainians as, quote unquote, one people with a common history. Others point out that he called the collapse of the Soviet Union, quote, the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the century. Of course, he also said, whoever does not miss the Soviet Union has no heart. Whoever wants it back has no brain. Still others point out that he said, modern Ukraine was entirely created by Russia, or to be more precise, by Bolshevik communist Russia, end of quote. But he went on to say in the same speech, quote, of course we cannot change past events, but we must at least admit them openly and honestly. To make the case that Putin was bent on conquering all of Ukraine and incorporating it into Russia, it is necessary to provide evidence that first, he thought it was a desirable goal, that second, he thought it was a feasible goal, and third, he intended to pursue that goal. There is no evidence, let me repeat, there is no evidence in the public record that Putin was contemplating, much less intending, to put an end to Ukraine as an independent state and make it part of a greater Russia when he sent his troops into Ukraine on February 24th. In fact, there is significant evidence that Putin recognized Ukraine as an independent country. In his July 12th, 2021 article about Russian-Ukrainian relations, which proponents of the conventional wisdom often point to as evidence of his imperial ambitions, he tells the Ukrainian people in that article, "You want to establish a state of your own?" Again, in an important speech he gave on February 21st of this year, Putin emphasized that Russia accepts, quote, the new geopolitical reality that took shape after the dissolution of the USSR. He reiterated that same point for a third time on February 24th when he announced that Russia would invade Ukraine. He also made it clear that it is not our plan to occupy Ukrainian territory and that he respected Ukrainian sovereignty, but only up to a point. To be a bit more specific and quote him, Russia cannot feel safe, develop, and exist while facing a permanent threat from the territory of today's Ukraine. In essence, Putin was not interested in making Ukraine part of Russia. He was interested in making sure it did not become, quote unquote, a springboard for Western aggression against Russia. Perhaps the best indicator that Putin is not bent on conquering and absorbing Ukraine is the military strategy Moscow has employed from the start of this campaign. The Russian military did not attempt to conquer all of Ukraine. That would have required a classic blitzkrieg strategy that aimed at quickly overrunning all of Ukraine with armored forces supported by tactical air power. That strategy was not feasible, however, because there were only 190,000 soldiers in Russia's invading army, which is far too small a force to vanquish and occupy Ukraine, which is not only the largest country between the Atlantic Ocean and Russia, but also has a population of over 40 million people. You're not going to conquer, occupy, and absorb a country of that size with 190,000 people. And you're not even going to have enough troops to launch a classic blitzkrieg, which is essential to conquer the entire country. Unsurprisingly, the Russians pursued a limited aim strategy, which focused on either capturing or threatening Kyiv and conquering a large swath of territory in eastern and southern Ukraine. In short, Russia did not have the capability to subdue all of Ukraine, much less conquer other countries in Europe. To take this argument a step further, Putin and other Russian leaders surely understand from the Cold War that occupying countries in the age of nationalism is invariably a prescription for never-ending trouble. The Soviet experience in Afghanistan is a glaring example of this phenomenon. It's obvious from Putin's July 12, 2021 essay, his famous essay, that he understands that Ukrainian nationalism is a powerful force, and that the civil war in the Donbass, which had been going on since 2014, had done much to poison relations between Russia and Ukraine. He surely knew that Russia's invasion force would not be welcomed with open arms by Ukrainians, and that it would be a Herculean task for Russia to subjugate Ukraine if it had the necessary forces to conquer the entire country, which it did not have. Finally, it's worth noting that hardly anyone made the argument that Putin had imperial ambitions from the time he first took office in 2000 until the Ukraine crisis first broke out on February 22, 2014. That's 14 years. Nobody made the argument that he had imperial ambitions in his first 14 years in office. In fact, the Russian leader was an invited guest to the April 2008 NATO summit in Bucharest, where the alliance announced that Ukraine and Georgia would eventually become members. He was invited to be there. Putin's opposition to that announcement had hardly any effect on Washington because Russia was judged to be too weak to stop further enlargement, just as it had been too weak to stop the 1990 tranche of enlargement, and just as it had been too weak to stop the 2004 tranche of expansion. Relatedly, it's important to note that NATO expansion before 2014, before the February 2014 crisis, was not aimed at containing Russia. Given the sad state of Russian military power, Moscow was in no position to pursue revanchist policies in Eastern Europe. Tellingly, former U.S. Ambassador to Moscow Michael McFaul notes that Putin's seizure of Crimea, that was in after the February 22, 2014 crisis started, was not planned before the crisis, but was an impulsive move in response to the coup that overthrew Ukraine's pro-Russian leader. In short, NATO enlargement was not intended to contain a Russian threat, but was intended instead as part of a broader policy to spread the liberal international order into Eastern Europe and make the entire continent look like Western Europe. It was only when the Ukraine crisis broke out in February 2014 that the United States and its allies suddenly began describing Putin as a dangerous leader with imperial ambitions, and Russia as a serious military threat that had to be contained. What happened? This new rhetoric was designed to serve one simple purpose: to allow the West to blame Putin for the outbreak of trouble in Ukraine. And now that the crisis has turned into a full-scale war, it is imperative to make sure that he alone is blamed for this disastrous turn of events. This blame game explains why Putin is widely viewed as an imperialist here in the West, even though there is hardly any evidence to support that perspective. Let me now turn to the real cause of the Ukraine crisis and ultimately the Ukraine war. The taproot is the American-led effort to make Ukraine a Western bulwark on Russia's borders. That strategy has three prongs. One, integrating Ukraine into the EU. Two, turning Ukraine into a pro-Western liberal democracy. You all know about the Orange Revolution. And three, and most importantly, incorporating Ukraine into NATO. The strategy was set in motion at NATO's annual summit in Bucharest in April 2008. When the alliance announced that Ukraine and Georgia will become members. That's in quotes, will become members. Russian leaders responded immediately with outrage, making it clear that this decision was an existential threat to Russia, and they had no intention of letting either country join NATO. According to a respected Russian journalist, Putin, quote, flew into a rage and warned that if Ukraine joins NATO, it will do so without Crimea and the eastern regions. It will simply fall apart. That's Putin talking in 2008. William Burns, who is now the head of the CIA, was then the U.S. ambassador to Moscow. This is at the time of the Bucharest summit. He wrote a memo to Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice that succinctly describes Russian thinking about Ukraine joining NATO. You want to pay very careful attention to what Burns said, and then what I'm going to tell you Angela Merkel has recently said. This is Burns. This is his memo. He's the U.S. ambassador in Moscow. It's his memo to Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. Quote, Ukrainian entry into NATO is the brightest of all red lines for the Russian elite, not just Putin. In more than 2.5 years of conversations with key Russian players, from knuckle draggers in the dark recesses of the Kremlin to Putin's sharpest liberal critics, I have yet to find anyone who views Ukraine and NATO as anything other than a direct challenge to Russian interests. NATO, he said, would be seen as throwing down the strategic gauntlet. Today's Russia will respond. Russian-Ukrainian relations will go into a deep freeze. It will create fertile soil for Russian meddling in Crimea and eastern Ukraine. Burns, of course, was not the only policymaker who understood that bringing Ukraine into NATO was fraught with danger. Indeed, at the Bucharest summit, at the summit itself, both German Chancellor Angela Merkel and French President Nicolas Sarkozy were opposed to moving forward on NATO membership for Ukraine because they feared it would infuriate Russia. Angela Merkel recently explained her opposition in an interview. I'm quoting Angela Merkel. I was very sure that Putin is not going to let this happen. From his perspective, that would be a declaration of war. Think about what Merkel, who opposed it in April 2008, is saying. She's saying that she knew that Putin would interpret it as a declaration of war. In other words, putting Ukraine in NATO would be a declaration of war. And Burns has just told you that Putin's not an anomaly, that every Russian member of the foreign policy elite, including the knuckle draggers in the recesses of the Kremlin that he has talked to, view it just as Putin views it. The Bush administration, which was pushing this policy decision for NATO, however, cared little about Moscow's brightest of red lines and pressured the French and German leaders to agree to issuing a public pronouncement that said unequivocally that Ukraine and Georgia would eventually join the alliance. Unsurprisingly, the American-led effort to integrate Georgia into NATO resulted in a war between Georgia and Russia in August 2008, just 4 months after the Bucharest summit. Nevertheless, in the wake of that war, the United States and its allies continued moving forward with their plans to make Ukraine a Western bastion on Russia's borders. These efforts eventually sparked a major crisis in February of 2014. After a U.S.-supported uprising caused Ukraine's pro-Russian president, Viktor Yanukovych, to flee the country. He was replaced by pro-American Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk. In response, Russia took Crimea from Ukraine and helped fuel a civil war that broke out in the Donbass between pro-Russian separatists and the Ukrainian government. One often hears the argument that in the 8 years between when the crisis broke out in February 2014 and when the war began in February 2022, you see that 8 year window there? Just to keep the big picture in your mind. August 2008, that's the Bucharest summit, but the crisis doesn't break out until February 2014. And then the war breaks out 8 years later, February 2022. The argument is that in the 8 years between when the crisis broke out and when the war broke out this past February, the United States and its allies paid little attention to bringing Ukraine into NATO. In effect, the issue had been taken off the table, and thus NATO enlargement could not possibly have been an important cause of the escalating crisis in 2021 and the subsequent outbreak of war earlier this year. This line of argument is false. In fact, the Western response to the events of 2014 was to double down on the existing strategy and effectively make Ukraine a de facto member of NATO. The alliance began training the Ukrainian military in 2014, averaging 10,000 trained troops annually over the next 8 years. NATO was training 10,000 troops per year for 8 straight years. In December 2017, the Trump administration decided to provide Kyiv with defensive weapons. Other NATO countries quickly got into the act, shipping even more weapons to Ukraine. In addition, Ukraine's military participated in joint military exercises with NATO forces. In July 2021, less than a year ago, Kyiv and Washington co-hosted Operation Sea Breeze, a naval exercise in the Black Sea that included navies from 31 countries and was directly aimed at Russia. 2 months later, in September 2021, the Ukraine Army led Rapid Trident 21, which was, according to an official press release from the U.S. Army, it was, quote, a U.S. Army Europe and Africa assisted annual exercise designed to enhance interoperability among allied and partner nations. Remember, I'm making the argument here. We were turning Ukraine into a de facto member of NATO. It was designed to enhance interoperability among allied and partner nations to demonstrate units are poised and ready to respond to any crisis. NATO's efforts to arm and train Ukraine's military explains in good part why it has fared so well against Russian forces in the ongoing war. It's not simply Russian incompetence. It's the fact that we armed and trained those Ukrainian forces and turned them into a formidable fighting force. A headline in a recent issue of the Wall Street Journal put it quite nicely. This is quoting that headline in the Wall Street Journal. The secret of Ukraine's military success, colon, years of NATO training. Years of NATO training. In addition to NATO's ongoing efforts to make the Ukrainian military a formidable fighting force, the politics surrounding Ukraine's membership in NATO and its integration into the West changed in 2021. There was renewed enthusiasm for pursuing Ukrainian membership in NATO in 2021. And the change took place in both Kyiv and in Washington. Let me start by telling you what happened in Kyiv. President Zelensky, who had never shown much enthusiasm for bringing Ukraine into NATO, and who was elected in March 2019 on a platform that called for working with Russia to settle the ongoing conflict crisis, reversed course in early 2021 and not only embraced NATO expansion, but also adopted a hardline approach toward Moscow. He made a series of moves like shutting down pro-Russian TV shows and stations, and arresting an especially close friend of Putin and charging him with treason. These were all moves that were sure to anger Moscow.
You're listening to John Mearsheimer on Causes and Consequences of the Ukraine War. This is Independent Alternative Radio. You can get copies of this program by calling us at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that's 1-800-444-1977. Or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
President Biden, who moved into the White House in January 2021. Biden is moving into the White House just as Zelensky is beginning to do a flip on his views towards Ukraine and towards Russia. President Biden had long been committed to bringing Ukraine into NATO and was also super hawkish towards Russia. And you want to remember that when he was vice president in the Obama administration, President Obama assigned him, Joe Biden, with the Ukraine portfolio. So he was no stranger to this issue. Unsurprisingly, on June 14th, 2021, NATO issued the following communique at its annual Brussels summit. I'm going to quote. "We reiterate the decision made at the 2008 Bucharest summit that Ukraine will become a member of the alliance, as an integral part of the process. We reaffirm all elements of that decision. We reaffirm all elements of that decision, as well as subsequent decisions, including that each partner will be judged on its own merits. We stand firm in our support for Ukraine's right to decide its own future and foreign policy course, free from outside interference." On September 1st, 2021, Zelensky visited the White House, where Biden made it clear in his public statements that the United States was, quote, "firmly committed to Ukraine's Euro-Atlantic aspirations." Then on November 10th, 2021, Secretary of State Tony Blinken and his Ukrainian counterpart signed an important document. It's called the U.S.-Ukraine Charter on Strategic Partnership. It's available on the website, or on the internet if you're interested. This is what it says. The aim of both parties is to, quote, "underscore a commitment to Ukraine's implementation of the deep and comprehensive reforms necessary for full integration into Europe and Euro-Atlantic institutions." That document explicitly builds not just on, quote, "the commitments made to strengthen the Ukraine-U.S. strategic partnership by Presidents Zelensky and Biden," end of quotes, but it also reaffirms the U.S. commitment to the, quote, 2008 Bucharest Summit Declaration. In short, there is little doubt that starting in early 2021, Ukraine began moving rapidly toward joining NATO. Some argue that while that may be true, we have decided it shouldn't have concerned Russian policymakers. Why? Because NATO is a defensive alliance and poses no threat to Russia. But that's not how Putin and other Russian leaders think about NATO. And it is what they think, not what you think or I think, that matters. And they see NATO as a direct threat. They see NATO expansion into Ukraine as an existential threat. They see it as the brightest of red lines. To deal with this growing threat, Putin stationed ever-increasing numbers of Russian troops on Ukraine's borders between February 2021 and February 2022. You remember last year? The number of Russian troops on Ukraine's borders continually increased and increased and increased. You ask yourself, why was that happening? It was happening in response to what Zelensky and Biden were doing, and all the arming and training was taking place. You noticed all those military exercises I described took place in 2021. Putin's aim was to coerce Biden and Zelensky into altering course and putting an end to their efforts to integrate Ukraine into the West. On December 17th, 2021, the Russians reached the boiling point, and Moscow sent separate letters to NATO and to Biden, demanding a written guarantee that, number one, Ukraine would not join NATO, no offensive weapons would be stationed near Russia's borders, and three, NATO troops and equipment moved into Eastern Europe since 1997 would be moved back to Western Europe. Putin made numerous public statements during this period that left no doubt that he viewed NATO expansion into Ukraine as an existential threat. Speaking to the Defense Ministry Board on December 21st, 2021, he stated, this is quoting Putin, "What they are doing or trying or planning to do in Ukraine is not happening thousands of kilometers away from our national border. It's on the doorstep of our house. They must understand that we simply have nowhere further to retreat to. Do they really think we do not see these threats? Or do they think that we will just stand idly by watching threats to Russia emerge?" 2 months later, at a press conference on February 22, 2022, this is 2 days before they invade, Putin said, quote, "We are categorically opposed to Ukraine joining NATO because this poses a threat to us, and we have arguments to support this. I have repeatedly spoken about it in this hall." He then made it clear that he recognized that Ukraine was becoming a de facto member of NATO. The United States and its allies, he said, quote, "continue to pump the current Kiev authorities full of modern types of weapons," end of quote. He went on to say that if this was not stopped, Moscow, quote, "would be left with an anti-Russia armed to the teeth. This is totally unacceptable." Putin's logic should be manifestly clear to Americans in the audience who have long understood, I'm sure, that we have a Monroe Doctrine which stipulates that no great power is allowed to place any of its military forces in the Western Hemisphere. I might note that in all of Putin's public statements during the months leading up to the war, there is not a scintilla of evidence that he was contemplating conquering Ukraine and making it part of Russia, much less attacking other countries in Eastern Europe. Other Russian leaders, including the defense minister, the foreign minister, the deputy foreign minister, and the Russian ambassador to NATO, to Washington, the Russian ambassador to Washington, also emphasized the centrality of NATO expansion for causing the Ukraine crisis. Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov made the point succinctly at a press conference on January 14th, 2022, when he said, "The key to everything," I'm quoting Lavrov now, "the key to everything is the guarantee that NATO will not expand eastward." Nevertheless, the efforts of Lavrov and Putin to get the United States and its allies to abandon their efforts to make Ukraine a Western bulwark on Russia's border failed completely. Secretary of State Tony Blinken responded to Russia's mid-December demands by simply saying, quote, "There is no change. There will be no change." Putin then launched an invasion of Ukraine to eliminate the threat he saw from NATO. Where are we now and where are we going? The Ukraine war has been raging for almost 4 months. And I would like to make three separate points. First of all, I'd like to talk about the specific consequences of this conflict for Ukraine, talk a little bit about the prospects for escalation, and talk a little bit about the prospects for ending the war in the foreseeable future. Starting with Ukraine, this war is an unmitigated disaster for Ukraine. As I noted earlier, Putin made it clear in 2008 that Russia would wreck Ukraine to prevent it from joining NATO. He is delivering on that promise. Russian forces have conquered at least 20% of Ukrainian territory and destroyed or badly damaged many Ukrainian cities and towns. More than 6.5 million Ukrainians have fled the country, while more than 8 million have been internally displaced. Many thousands of Ukrainians, including innocent civilians, are dead or badly wounded, and the Ukrainian economy is in shambles. The World Bank estimates that Ukraine's economy will shrink by almost 50% over the course of 2022. Estimates are that approximately $100 billion worth of damage has been inflicted on Ukraine already, and it will take close to $1 trillion to rebuild the country. In the meantime, Kyiv requires about $5 billion of aid every month just to keep the government running. Furthermore, there appears to be little hope that Ukraine will be able to regain use of the Azov and Black Seas, the ports on the Azov and Black Seas, anytime soon. Before the war, roughly 70% of all Ukrainian exports and imports and 98% of its grain exports move through these ports. This is the basic situation after less than 4 months of fighting. It is downright scary to contemplate what Ukraine is going to look like if this war drags on for a few more years. So, this brings me to the second topic I want to talk about. What are the prospects for negotiating a peace agreement and ending this war in the next few months? I am sorry to say that I see no way this war ends anytime soon. And this is a view shared by prominent policymakers on both the Western side and the Russian side. The main reason for my pessimism is that both Russia and the United States are deeply committed to winning the war, and it is impossible to reach an agreement where both sides win. To be more specific, the key to a settlement from Russia's perspective is making Ukraine a neutral state, which means that Ukraine must divorce itself from the West, especially the United States. But that outcome is unacceptable to the Biden administration and a large portion of the American foreign policy establishment, because it would represent a victory for Russia. Ukrainian leaders have agency, of course, and thus one might hope that given all the horror being inflicted on their country, they will push for neutralization. Indeed, Zelensky briefly mentioned that possibility in the first month of the war, but he never seriously pursued it. There's little chance, however, that Kyiv will push for neutralization, because the ultra-nationalists in Ukraine, who wield significant political power, have zero interest in yielding to any of Russia's demands, especially one that dictates Ukraine's political alignment with the outside world. The Biden administration and the countries on NATO's eastern flank, and here we're talking about Poland and the Baltic states, they're likely to support Ukraine's ultra-nationalists, along with the Americans, on this whole issue of creating a neutral Ukraine. To complicate matters further, how does one deal with the large swaths of Ukrainian territory that Russia has conquered since the war started, as well as Crimea's fate? It's hard to fathom Moscow giving up any of the Ukrainian territory it now occupies, much less all of it, at least in the foreseeable future. Russia's territorial goals today are probably not the ones they started the war with. At the same time, it's difficult to imagine any Ukrainian leader accepting a deal that allows Russia to keep any Ukrainian territory, except possibly Crimea. I certainly hope I'm wrong, but I see no end in sight to this ruinous war. Let me turn to the final matter, which is the matter of escalation. It's widely accepted among international relations scholars that there is a powerful tendency for protracted wars to escalate. Other countries get dragged into the fight, and the level of violence is likely to escalate. The potential for this happening in Ukraine is real. There is a danger that the United States and its NATO allies will get dragged into the fighting, which they have been able to avoid up to this point, even though we are now effectively at war with Russia. There's also the possibility that nuclear weapons might be used in Ukraine, and that might even lead to a nuclear exchange between Russia and the United States. The underlying reason that these outcomes might be realized is that the stakes are so high for both sides, and thus neither can afford to lose. As I have emphasized, Putin and his lieutenants believe that Ukraine joining the West is an existential threat to Russia that must be eliminated. In practical terms, that means Russia must win its war in Ukraine. Defeat is unacceptable. The Biden administration, on the other hand, has stressed that its goal is not only to defeat the Russians in Ukraine, but also to use massive sanctions to do egregious damage to the Russian economy. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin has emphasized that the West's goal is to weaken Russia to the point where it could not invade Ukraine again. In effect, the Biden administration is committed to knocking Russia out of the ranks of the great powers. At the same time, President Biden himself has called Russia's war in Ukraine a genocide and charged Putin with being a war criminal who should face, quote, a war crimes trial after the war. Such rhetoric hardly lends itself to negotiating an end to the war. After all, how do you negotiate with a genocidal state? American policy has two significant consequences. For starters, it greatly amplifies the existential threat Moscow faces in this war, and it makes it more important than ever that Moscow prevail in Ukraine. At the same time, it means that the United States is deeply committed to making sure that Russia loses. The Biden administration has now invested so much in the war, both materially and rhetorically, that a Russian victory would represent a devastating defeat for Washington. Obviously, both sides can't win. Moreover, there's a serious possibility that one side will begin to lose badly. There is a serious possibility of that. If American policy succeeds and the Russians are losing to the Ukrainians on the battlefield, Putin might turn to nuclear weapons to rescue the situation. The U.S. Director of National Intelligence, Averill Haynes, told the Senate this past May that this was one of the two situations that might lead Putin to use nuclear weapons if he is losing in Ukraine. For those of you who think it's unlikely that he would turn to use nuclear weapons to rescue the situation if he's losing in Ukraine, I would remind you that NATO planned to use nuclear weapons in similar circumstances during the Cold War. We were planning to use nuclear weapons in West Germany if the Warsaw Pact overran West Germany. If we were losing against the Warsaw Pact in West Germany, we were going to turn to nuclear weapons to rescue the situation. That's what we're talking about Putin doing. You don't think he'll do it? I wouldn't bet a lot of money on that. If Russia were to employ nuclear weapons in Ukraine, it's difficult to say how the Biden administration would react, but it would surely be under great pressure to retaliate, thus raising the possibility of a great power nuclear war. There is a perverse paradox at play here. You really want to think about this. The more successful we are, the United States and its allies, at achieving our war aims, the more likely it is that the war will turn nuclear. Let's turn the tables and ask what happens if the United States and its NATO allies appear to be heading toward defeat, which effectively means that the Russians are routing the Ukrainian military and the government in Kyiv is moving to negotiate a peace deal to hold on to as much of Ukraine as possible. In that event, there would be tremendous pressure on the United States and its allies to get even more deeply involved in the fighting. It is not likely, but certainly possible, that America or maybe Polish troops would get pulled into the fighting, which means NATO would not effectively be at war with Russia. It would literally be at war with Russia. This is the other scenario, according to Averill Haines, the director of National Intelligence, where the Russians might turn to nuclear weapons. It is difficult to say precisely how events will play out in the Ukraine war, but there is no question that there will be serious potential for escalation, to include nuclear escalation. The mere possibility of that outcome should send shivers down your spine. There are likely to be other disastrous consequences from the war. For example, there's reason to think that the war will lead to a food crisis in which many millions of people will die. Furthermore, relations between Russia and the West have been so thoroughly poisoned that it will take many years to repair them, maybe even decades. In the meantime, that profound hostility will foster instability around the globe and especially in Europe. One might agree, but note that there's a silver lining. Relations among countries in the West have markedly improved. Transatlantic relations have improved. NATO and the EU are in better shape than ever. That's true for the moment, but there are deep fissures below the surface, which are likely to manifest themselves over time. For example, I would expect that relations between the countries of Eastern and Europe will deteriorate as the war drags on. Finally, the conflict is already damaging the global economy in major ways, and the situation is likely to get much worse with time. The CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase says that we should brace ourselves for an economic hurricane. These economic shocks, of course, in turn, will affect the politics of every Western country, undermining liberal democracy and strengthening its opponents on both the left and the right. In conclusion, the ongoing conflict in Ukraine is a colossal disaster, which, as I noted at the start of my talk, will lead people all around the world to search for its causes. Those who believe in facts and logic will quickly discover that the United States and its allies are mainly responsible for this train wreck. The April 2008 decision to bring Ukraine and Georgia into NATO was destined to lead to conflict with Russia. The Bush administration was the principal architect of that fateful choice, but the Obama, Trump, and Biden administrations have doubled down on that policy at every turn. And America's allies have dutifully followed. Even though Russia's leaders made it perfectly clear that bringing Ukraine into NATO would be crossing the brightest of red lines, the United States simply refused to accommodate Russia's deepest security concerns and instead moved relentlessly to make Ukraine a Western bulwark on Russia's border. The tragic truth is that if the West had not pursued NATO expansion into Ukraine, it is unlikely there would be a war in Ukraine today, and Crimea would still be part of Ukraine. In essence, Washington played the central role in leading Ukraine down the path to destruction. History will judge the United States and its allies with abundant harshness for its remarkably foolish policy on Ukraine. Thank you.
You were just listening to John Mearsheimer on causes and consequences of the Ukraine war. He spoke at the European University Institute in Florence, Italy, on June 16th. John Mearsheimer is Wendell Harrison Distinguished Service Professor in the Political Science Department at the University of Chicago. He's the author of numerous books on international relations. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are an independent, progressive nonprofit in our 37th year. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. We've done a series of programs on the Ukraine war, featuring Noam Chomsky, Ray McGovern, Katrina Vandenhoevel, and Chris Hedges. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To get copies of today's program, John Mearsheimer on Causes and Consequences of the Ukraine War, and for Noam Chomsky's classic book, Requiem for the American Dream, Principles of Wealth and Power, just give us a call, 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. We're offering printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program at no charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.
So that concludes this week's edition of Gray Matters. We'll be back next week with another hour-long presentation from Alternative Radio down in Boulder, Colorado. Check out their website at www.alternativeradio.org. Coming up on CKUT is Pirate Block Radio. Tromotext will be back next week. Okay, till then, stay safe.
Quality sounds, tune into CKUT 90.3 on the frequency modulation band radio. www.ckut.ca on the internet. Streaming audio, archive shows, and information.
CKUT.
Politica is thrilled to announce the theatrical release of Dear Jackie, a feature documentary by Henri Pardo. The film opens on June 17 in 4 theaters in Montreal: Cinéma Public, Cinéma du Musée, Cinémathèque Québécoise, and Cinéma Moderne, with the director and special guests in attendance at select screenings. Dear Jackie poetically tells the story of one of the oldest black communities in Canada, Montreal's Little Burgundy, by way of a cinematic letter to Jackie Robinson, the first black man to break the color barrier in professional baseball. It also masterfully connects history to the present by challenging the myth of a post-racial society. This release is co-presented by Desta Black Youth Network, Tyndale St. George's Community Center, Canteen Bergs, and Makisia Solo. For more information and tickets, visit cinemapolitica.org. We hope to see you there. This is a CKUT co-presentation.
Hello and welcome. You are tuned into CKUT 90.3 FM, and it has become time for this month's episode of Pirate Block Radio. With you today is me, your host, Malte Leander, that will be guiding you through the next hour of topics around digital art practices, inventive media art, and related topics, with this show coming out of Jejage, also known as Montreal, located on unceded Indigenous lands. We have come to the last episode for this season, coming back in full effect again in the new year. The January episode will consist of a look back into the vault of past years of interviews, discussions, and events since Pirate Block Radio has been on air since back in 2015. But let's focus on today's schedule. We are, to say the least, ending on a high point today with two interesting artists and creators that I have had the chance to talk to. Both of these artists are having scheduled residencies at the Digital Arts Center Eastern Bloc here in Montreal. Projects in research creation, including instrument building and performance through explorations of meetings between the past and the current. With me today to talk about these things and more is a specialist in early